Accession number 8736, rule number 46.
Lord Harding, tape 46. Could I ask you a little more about the collective fines? What were these?
Well, they were fines imposed on a community, like this case at Lefconico, and they were in terms of so much money, which had to be provided by the community. It was a rare thing to do, but it was done, and in some occasions, where in a case like that, where the community at large could be claimed to be responsible for what happened. But there are two, I think, main principles that you've got to try and maintain in all these things, and the first and perhaps the most important is that everyone should know where they stand. I have been told, I don't know how authentically, some people, responsible people in Cyprus, who were in Cyprus during the emergency, both Greeks and Turks, have said that they didn't agree with the policies that I pursued, but at least they knew where they stood. And I think consistency in your policy and in your actions are extremely important. You mustn't chop and change. I mean, you must change if the situation changes. Don't misunderstand me about that. But people must know. The public as a whole must know how they stand in regard to the conduct of anti-terrorist operations. That's one thing. And the other is that your own security forces must know how far they can go, what the constraints have got to be placed on their accent. And one of my slogans was, as far as the security forces in their dealings with the general public was, that they must be firm but fair and courteous. And that was the sort of slogan, a guideline: fair, firm but fair and courteous. And they must know precisely where they stand in carrying out their duties in defeating terrorism and restoring law and order. They must know exactly what their powers of arrest are, when they should shoot and when they should not shoot. And these things are terribly important. The British Army has had widespread experience of these problems, and I think there is what's called the doctrine or the philosophy of minimum force, and that is applicable to situations of these kinds. Sometimes it's interpreted by critics and journalists in the wrong way, in my opinion. But who is to decide what is a minimum force? So these are sort of general principles that it is very important to follow and to observe, but above all, to make certain, as certain as you can, the general public, where they stand, what is permitted and what is a breach of security, and to the security forces what their powers are and how they should exercise them, what constraints must be placed on their action. These are very important things.
If I could just go back to the collective fines for a moment, if you would bear with me.
Yeah.
How would you have assessed? Was there some sort of means test? Because obviously there would have been great differences in income.
Yes, well, you would, in assessing this sum, I would be advised by the local district commissioner.
And the individual contribution, would that have been done by means testing?
Well, that would have been done by the local, what corresponded in there to the local government, I mean, to the Mukhtar, for the Turks are concerned, and to the, probably to the priest, or the mayor, if it was a town, with a mayor, to the civic authorities. That would be their responsibility for deciding on the individual contribution.
Was there much sort of dissatisfaction with that from the population?
Of course.
Were they
yes, they're bound to be. Yes, of course. I don't, looking back on it all, I don't think it's a particularly effective security measure, and I doubt if I was doing it all over again or in another context, I doubt if I would use it except very possibly in extreme. It wasn't used very often in Cyprus. I don't know how many cases there were, but there weren't many. I think you would probably count them on the fingers of both hands.
And would you have used that to sort of cover bombing, sabotage, damage to property mainly? To have regained...
Well, not mainly. I mean, it all depends on the circumstances. Something for which you could hold the community, the village or the town community or the district community as a whole responsible. And that's rare. I can't tell you how many cases, but there may have been less than the fingers of one hand. Certainly not very many. That's right. Now, what you have to do, at least in my opinion, what you need to do is you have to assess the effect of fines on individual members of the community and on the community as a whole against the, as whether or not it's going to be a deterrent against the sympathy or fear which they have, the sympathy in support of IOCA, or the fear of retribution by IOCA. And this is a balance that, it's what I call the balance of fear. Fear of punishment by the court, fear of defeat by the security forces, on the one hand, and fear of retribution or punishment by IOCA on the other hand. And this had a big bearing on the extent to which captured IOCA personnel would talk. And a guerrilla leader like Grivas is absolutely ruthless in maintaining the loyalty and discipline of his own followers. I mean, there were cases whereby IOCA executed its own people for what they called treachery, as it was talking or being informers. Exactly the same thing goes on everywhere. In any state of emergency, you will have it in Ireland, kneecap it.
The detention of persons laws, did you find that a useful device?
Yes, that was. That, as I said, detention, arrest and detention without trial of suspects is an effective measure in dealing with an emergency. At the same time, it comes under very heavy criticism, always. And so what was done in Cyprus was to set up a court, sort of an investigation court, as to who would review cases of detention, a review institution to review cases of detention without trial and decide whether the facts or the evidence available warranted their continued detention or whether they could safely, for security reasons, be released. And that is a process which was established in Cyprus, and which was, I think, probably effective. But there again, it's extremely difficult to reach a sound decision.
Were there any limitations regarding age or sex regarding the detention of persons?
No, I don't think you can have those sort of limitations.
How young a person could you sort of hold, do you think?
As long as you liked. As long as you thought it was necessary.
So would you have taken children, you know, if
no, probably wouldn't take juveniles, no. No, I don't think. The one barrier to taking juveniles is that they're looking after them. And they were in detention. No, I don't remember any cases of juveniles being detained without trial.
How about deportations?
Well, the only deportation that I ordered, and I think was carried out during my time, was that of Archbishop Macarius, and I'll explain the reasons for that. I don't think there may have been people turned back at the ports of entry or the airport on suspicion of there being a security risk. That may have happened, but I don't think any actual other arrest and deportation from Cyprus. I don't think so. Certainly, at the ports of entry and the airport, there were security checks, and may well have been. I think there must have been cases in which people were turned back as being suspects.
Could I ask you now about this very important aspect, interrogation methods used on Cyprus?
Well, what did happen, of course, and there were complaints and appeals about the ill treatment of captured Ioka people, of cruelty and torture used in interrogation. As far as ill treatment, rough treatment on capture, I think that's something that inevitably does happen. After all, if you've got troops or police who are engaged in an anti-terrorist operation and they've seen some of their comrades killed in action, well, then they capture some of the enemy responsible. Naturally, they are liable to be rough-handled. And that is a perfectly natural thing to happen and not something which you can regulate against. I don't think it happened to any serious extent in Cyprus, but certainly there were occasions when a captured Ioka man was pretty roughly handled in the course of his arrest. And that's something which is perfectly natural and, to my mind, acceptable. But what is not acceptable, of course, is any form of torture or ill treatment under interrogation. And there were allegations, and there still are allegations made, that the police in Cyprus did indulge in torture and rough treatment in the course of interrogation. There was one case which was investigated, and the culprit was found. It was found that something of that kind had happened. It was on capture of a prisoner, I think, not actually during interrogation. And that the individual concerned was dealt with by trial in court martial, if it was a soldier, I can't remember what. But I had complete confidence in the police and army officers responsible for the conduct of interrogation, and I'm quite certain, with that confidence, that these allegations of torture and ill treatment under interrogation are unfounded. If they had been properly founded, if they had gone on, then I believe that the officers responsible, I should have got, would have got to know about them, and in that case, the individuals responsible would have been tried and punished. My view is that there may have been rough handling of IOCA personnel on capture in an actual operation. I don't believe there was torture or ill treatment in interrogation. And if there had been, I think it would have come to light. And although various investigations were made, and of course allegations are made, they're bound to be made. I mean, it's a tactic. It's one of the well-known and fully understood and practiced tactics of the terrorist organization. And that's the way I look at it.
Were you ever present yourself? You know, did you make checks of these things?
No.
Because that really would have been outside
That I think would have been wrong. I mean, if you employ people to do these jobs, you know about them, and you trust them to do the job properly.
I understand that IOCA produced a little, I think it was called a black book, listing these alleged mistreatments of prisoners. Did you know anything about that?
No. Well, I may have known it of its existence, but I certainly didn't. That would have been looked at by the security staff, if it came to their knowledge and notice.
So would you have?
I don't consider that is the responsible of a commander. That is the action required of a commander in chief. He has. Down the line, the responsibility is placed on responsible and properly trained individuals, both policemen and soldiers.
Was an inquiry ever requested?
There was,
while you were
there? I think the Human Rights Commission sent out an inquiry, but they couldn't find anything of any significance.
That actually went ahead, did it?
Yeah.
The inquiry.
Yeah. To the best of my belief, I can't remember in detail, but I know that what was done produced no evidence of any significance. Yeah. I had, of course, overall responsibility for all the actions which were taken by the security forces, and if I had reason to think that anyone would carrying out their duties in a responsible way, I would have taken action against them and dealt with them.
Could I ask you now about searches? Were the authorities, did they have freedom to search anyone at any time?
Security forces, yes. One of their responsibilities was, and searches were made both of property, houses, and of individuals. Oh yes, that's a necessary power that security forces must have, power of search.
And there again, how about the limits of limitations regarding age and sex? Could they have searched children? Were they suspected of carrying things? Or women, for instance, were they?
Well, if you have women policemen, you would, women would be searched by a woman policeman.
Is that so? You didn't have the case where a male would search.
Yes.
No, because I could, appreciate there might be a few problems.
Well, there are problems, I think. But again, I mean, the responsible officer, whether he's a platoon commander or a sergeant or a regimental battalion commander or a senior policeman. They are responsible for seeing that things are properly done. And to the best of my knowledge and belief, they were properly done. And there was no breach of the proper laws and proper rules of search.
You mentioned the search of property as well. Did you ever have occasion to perhaps search religious places, such as monasteries? No, and did that present any problems?
Yes, I think so. I don't remember any individual cases, but I think so, yes, of course.
Yes, would that have caused any particular problem?
Well, of course it caused resentment. Yes, everything, anything like that does. Whether they were produced any evidence or not is another matter. But if matters of life and death are involved, you can't overlook any possible source of terror. I mean, whether it's the hoarding or the hiding of ammunition, explosives, or the hiding of individuals. And nothing can justify overlooking a search of a building, whatever its purpose is, if there is suspicion that it's hiding or you've been used in furtherance of a terrorist campaign.
Was it ever necessary to cordon off areas? I think this might have happened in Nicosia at one time. Did you not have a division of populations in Nicosia? Was it called
I don't know.
The Mason-Dixon line. That in your time?
No, that was later. No, that was the Mason-Dixon line, I think, was produced when the United Nations force was there. The police may have found it necessary to cordon off parts of a town or an area at different times. I don't know. That was the matter for them to decide.
Would you think there was any divergence regarding the penalties meted out to Greeks and Turks?
I hope not. I don't think so.
Were you ever criticised that the Greeks might remember. Have been
I don't
more
remember any. No, I don't remember anything. There was a lot of criticism about the use of the Turkish mobile police force their methods were too rough and severe or whatever. No, I don't think so.
You've given a very good indication, Lord Harding, how difficult it is, deciding on these measures. But generally, you did decide on a pretty firm line in Cyprus. You have mentioned that you have doubts about some aspects of this, such as the collective fines. But taken as a whole, do you think you did right? Was it right at that time to take such a firm line?
Oh, yes, I think you can't possibly inflict a defeat on a terrorist organization unless you adopt all these measures as and when you think they're necessary, and unless you conduct your anti-terrorist campaign just as you would conduct a campaign in a sort of set-piece war against this declared enemy. I mean, it is a war. Anti-terrorist operations and terrorist operations between the security forces and the terrorist organization is war. And war had to be conducted in a ruthless, arbitrary way. Otherwise, you're wasting both lives and time.
You mentioned earlier this balance that you have to strike between imposing these measures, which hopefully are going to make the situation better, and perhaps alienating the population.
Well, that's a question of the deterrent value of the penalties or the measures that you intend or think of using, and you don't impose constraints and hardships on the general public unless you believe that it is going to have a deterrent effect and be damaging to the terrorist organization's operations.
Were you always aware of the risk that your measures might be counterproductive, that it might put their backs up?
Of course. That's something you have to try and balance it out Of course, you have to, as far as the general political situation and developments were concerned, it's always a question of holding a proper balance between what I call Greek aspirations for Ennis's and Turkish fears that Ennis's would be come about. So it's a question of balance between Turkish fears and Greek aspirations. And I've always tried to hold an impartial balance in that respect, and still do. I was asked some time ago now by a Greek who'd written a book on the Cyprus problem. And he wrote to me told me about this book. He'd written it, and I think he was at that time doing a job at the Cyprus Commission, High Commissioned Office in London. He wrote and said that he'd written this book, and would I write a foreword for him? So I said, all right, if you send me the script, I explained that I'd always tried to remain impartial between Greek aspirations and Turkish fears. If he sent me the script, I'd read it, and then I'd decide whether I was prepared to write an introduction to it. And he sent me the script. Some of it was very sensible and rational, but some of it was also very partisan, pro-Greek, partisan on the Greek side. So I wrote back and said, no, I won't, because I've always tried to maintain this position of complete impartiality. And if our name is attached to your book, that will damage my position of impartiality. He then wrote back and said that he was a historian. He very much liked to have a talk with me about the history of the Cyprus problem. And so I said, all right, of course. And I asked him to come and have a cup of coffee with me once when I was in London. He came. He bought the usual bottle of Kir brandy as a gift. And then I asked him, why did you ask me to write an introduction to your book? And he said, his reply was, the Archbishop suggested that I should do so.
Did you have much criticism from Greece, from the mainland of Greece, about your policies?
Oh, yes, plenty. Yes, they were critical, and their broadcasts, of course, were very critical and were in full support of IOKA and of the campaign for Ennis's. So much so that at one time, we decided that it was necessary to jam them, which we did, and we jammed the broadcasts from Athens. Again, to what extent that curbed enthusiasm or support for IOKA in Cyprus is open to question. But from the point of view of the security forces and of the Turkish opinion, It was important, because whatever the real significance of the broadcast was to in support of IOKA, both the security forces and the Turks thought that it was, and therefore it was necessary to do this. I think it was wasn't necessary. It was sensible, and it's something you don't like doing, the same way censorship of the press. But when they are deliberately inciting people to terror and terrorism, then I think it's necessary to do it.